So it's a cogeneration, and here we're showing water and steam going through as coolant and electricity as well coming out. And
is 9.5 kilowatts thermal or electrical?
That's electrical, thermal 7 or so. Yeah. Because, converting to electrical with thermoelectrics at these temperatures is not that efficient.
Yeah.
Now, we have a problem with our system at the moment. Why not a problem? I think everyone has this issue. The way we keep it going over a long period of time is we have to pressurize and depressurize. And so this makes the system a little bit more complicated. And so what we have is actually two of those that we run simultaneously. And so this one over here, we have a compressor at this point, which is compressing the hydrogen going into this one. That was producing heat and so on. And what this one on the other side is being decompressed, which is what we want. And so we switch back in a cycle over about an hour. We switch in reverse procedure, and we depressurize the one on the left and pressurize the one on the right. And that gives us this sort of a time average average heat output between the two.
What was the highest and lowest pressure?
Well, it depends. We've gone up to 10 atmospheres normally.
And what's the cycle time?
Well, that's to be determined, but as I say, about an hour.
Long, anyway.
And so this summarizes what I said. We have this cyclic operation. And so now, compared to, I don't know what other people are doing, when we went to ICCF 18, we had that Skype thing with the Greek company, and they were using a spark plasma arc initiation. I'll be explaining this later, but we use pressure alone, and other people have other things. I think some way to keep running over a long period of time, the key is to keep a flow of deuterium going and through the clusters, and so we need to do something like this. So now, with that, it's sort of interesting to see what this system, which is not optimized, might do in terms of competition. And what we envision this competing with is the other green energy, solar, wind, and so on. And so if we use this unit I just described, the 1.5 kilowatt electric, which, we can easily make it bigger if we want to, we end up with something like this. It ends up costing to make that about $3,000 or so, according to our estimate. $2 per watt install. For comparison, that's about a half to a fifth of equal size solar or wind or fuel cells. And this is the first generation, so those prices have come down.
Is that for two reactors or for one?
That's the two reactor system. Yeah. And now we have the operational cost is mainly dominated by these nanoparticles. Now we've done various things. We think we can keep them from centering and doing bad things. Maybe for 6 months. By 6 months, the reactions themselves are starting to cause them to disintegrate. So we don't really know that since we've never run more than about 40 hours, frankly. So this is a huge guess. I don't know what's going to happen. But we assume that 6 months. So the cost is the recycling of the nanoparticles, and we figure that's about $500 per reload of nanoparticles. And the gas and maintenance are assumed to be low and so on. So this gives us a very nice operational cost. And consequently, based on that, we have, jumped my head for some reason, we have a 7 cents per kilowatt hour versus 15 is current average household price. And so when you do put the numbers there, the key bottom line is this is about a 3-year payback time, after which we start enjoying, a payback. The cost of electricity is 7 versus 15, so you start making about $1,000 a year from this unit. And compared to
15 cents for main, something on the mains.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you.
And so compared to these other types of things, solar and so on, you know, they have cost when the sun's not shining, you have to get it from somewhere, or they have to have energy storage or something. Anyway, this is extremely attractive compared to them.
What's the power gains in this room?
I'll show some gains coming up. And I think the market potential is significant. No greenhouse gas emission. 24-hour operation, compact size. You know, the size, despite having the two units, the size is very compact compared to having this big solar panel on your house and things of that sort. So, very attractive. And this 3-day, 3 years payback period is very attractive. So this, if you could do what we're talking about, and that's a big if you could do it, it'd be a very, very remarkable thing.
Did you assume that the heating was free? You only talk about the electricity cost, not the normal gas or oil heating in the house.
Well, no, we're just talking about the electricity and you know, the heating is a given, you know. So, anyway, this has some major uncertainties. I've already mentioned them. I think lifetime being one of the big ones. The ability to recycle these. We assume that, the metal is not consumed to any extent, so we assume that the nanoparticles are essentially recycled and you aren't buying new metal. So you could use palladium, and sometimes in our combinations we talk about palladium without worrying. I mean, nickel's cheaper, but there may be some advantages otherwise. But, anyway, we think if we got money, we could get this thing operating in 2 years. That's another assumption. We have reported a number of meetings about our thin film work and our cluster work based on that, and that was all electrolytic. And we had great success with that, but you were asking about the gains are always low. I don't think we could make a very attractive unit out of that because of the low gains we have. So we wanted to go to something that had higher gains, have larger surface area, and we wanted to not be limited by the boiling temperature of the fluid if we have an electrolytic type of thing. So we've obviously gone, as many people had already gone before us, to clusters. And with clusters, you have the advantage that you can get many more of these nanoparticles, can have many more places for the clusters to be formed in them, as opposed to the thin film. The thin film, the clusters are mainly along the surfaces, almost none in the bulk volume. Nanoparticles all over the thing, hopefully. So we've been investigating a variety of different compositions, and we sort of classified them broadly. Palladium, zirconium, type A, B, added nickel to that, and then C was high nickel. Sort of the thought was we can use the first type with deuterium, nickel one's best with hydrogen, so on. And the alloy baking procedures, we have the alloys made, we bake them, so on. This is sort of a gruesome part of all this work. We make our own nanoparticles by milling. And by the time all this is done, to get 30 grams, we're spending about $3,000 to $5,000. And so they aren't cheap, which has limited our ability to run a lot of them. And as you'll see, in desperation to do that, what we've done is we have gone back to what I sort of abbreviated experiments where we only use a few grams, which I think gives us good data on the operation of the nanoparticles without expending large amount of money. And so that's a little bit like the combinational chemistry that you were talking about earlier. We're trying to use small batches, and then we'll go to the big ones once we narrow things down. And we get the desired oxidation. Typically, we completely oxidize the zirconium. Zirconium's in it. And but we measure all that by weight gain, so we know how much oxidation is there, and that's very important for lifetime as well as for trying to understand possible chemical reactions. And so that's our procedure, and we ball mill this, giving compositions. I think nanoparticles are not quite what we're using. We're using microparticles. We have this sieving. We have maybe typically 70% to below 53 micrometers and so on. And Brian Ahern, I think, made a very good point about, there's some magic number. He's talking about the size of the nanoparticles, but here I think the magic number applies to the size of the defect or the dislocation loop where the cluster's made. And that's the crucial dimension. It's that size, and it's the number per cubic centimeter that determine what's going on. So the actual size of the particles is less crucial, except we want to use the surface area very efficiently. And so now it's very interesting. I asked one of the students to compare ours to nanars. Now, it's interesting when you look at all this, our one composition, which has all the elements in it, is very close to what the nanars are using. And I know Mitchell has several different compositions than we do. Anyway, if you look at what we do, we may not do it in quite the same steps, but we end up about the same results, except the way he does it after that and the way we do it after that is grossly different. I think the nanar is brilliant. Well, you then preload it and run it as an electrical resistor, right?
Yes.
And what we're doing is not that. What we put it in the device. We do this cyclic operation to try to make defects in it, and then we run it at high pressure. But maybe there's some in-between ground. I don't know. It's interesting. That's what I'm thinking about. Anyway, our system is very simple, picture of it. And the business end is this little cylinder here, which, it's only about 25 cubic centimeters volume. If it's filled up to here, it's 30 grams of those nanoparticles. And in the system it's put here, we have valving and so on, so that we can go to very hard vacuum, bake it, so on and so forth, and then open valves suddenly and introduce the gas directly. And we can also reverse valves and degas it. And so all of that's built in. And as shown here, for quick experiments, we just use some sort of insulation. We have a complete, and shown here, we have a complete sort of calorimetry set that we put around it also we use, but that's sort of awkward to put on and take off if we're doing a lot of fast experiments like I'll show you here. So we've been doing two types of experiments. I call them kinetic and adiabatic. Adiabatics are done so quickly that we don't have major heat losses, so we can run it like I showed you without worrying much about the heat transfer. And Kinetic's looking at what's going on. And this I've shown times before. It sort of illustrates what we found. We note the time scale here is in seconds. And so we start to run, and this was about 25 grams of nanoparticles, 23 grams, I guess, of that type A I showed you before. And high purity gas, we start the pressurizing right here. There are several thermocouples at different locations. This first jump is due to the heating, due to the exochemical reaction, due to the absorption of the, in this case, I think this was actually deuterium gas, because that didn't have nickel in it. And so it jumps up to that temperature, and then the LNR reaction takes over and takes it up to here. We quickly unload it at this point, and that should be an endothermic chemical reaction. It should go down like this. Instead, it goes up. And the explanation for that is very important, because it illustrates the importance of this diffusion process. We need, you know, if we load these clusters and we just have them sitting there at constant pressure, not much is going to happen. What we have to do is at least get something to diffuse in, transfer a momentum to one, so that the whole system starts reacting. And so the diffusion process is obviously very important. Now, people have known that, you know, go back to Mike McCoovery's and everybody else's work. They always say that you have to have a flow as well as a loading. And I'm talking about the flow here. And so we have that. And coincidentally, here, though, if we calculate the chemical reaction versus in just that little bit of time, the chemical reaction versus the total joules out, we find that we have roughly double the joules out, about 1,500 versus the chemical, about 700. Now, there's a big argument about what the chemical the chemical reactions are and how you should calculate that. And we spent umpteen experiments and time working on that. And some of that was discussed in the ICCF 18 meeting. I don't have time to go through all that. But we tried to eliminate the chemical reactions. I mean, we tried to include in the calculation the chemical reactions and not miss one, but That's always a question. You can't convince someone to eliminate it. What we need to do is measure the reaction products. And, you know, we did that very systematically earlier with the thin films. We have lots of papers on that. But here, we've been limited, and it's also very hard to do. We had some results that were shown at ICCF 18 in some papers I referenced at the end of this, but it's difficult, and we frankly have not succeeded in satisfying ourselves we know what direction products are, which is embarrassing, but time will tell. Now, if we didn't deload at that point in that last graph, you'd get something like this, and this is a time scale minutes, so I know the temperature comes back down in an hour or so. Now, the reason is we don't have enough nanoparticles in there. We haven't reached an equilibrium. The heat loss is greater than the heat gain in that system without any outer chamber, so it comes back down fairly quickly. If we have the outer vessel on, it's going to come down much more slowly, but it will still come down unless we depressurize. And so we're back to what I started with double systems. What we need to do is we need to, once it starts coming down, depressurized so we can go back up again. And we need to oscillate back and forth. And we need to do that so we want to keep this these limits as close as possible. We want the upper limit as high as possible for good heat transfer and good conversion efficiency. And so we want to narrow those two and get the best average possible. We've done a lot of then experiments where we tried to compare different nanoparticles and their preparation and everything. It's sufficiently complicated. I can't really do a good job of explaining all that. But these experiments are easy to have a couple of grams of nanoparticles in them. And if we do that in an amazingly small time, depending on what the nanoparticle is, it'll shoot way up like this. This is carbon black down here. This is this is type A again, one that I showed in that first slide, goes up, comes down. If we, after it's done that, we bake it under high vacuum for a couple hours and repeat the measurement, it'll do this. It's not fully recovered. Actually, we have to bake it overnight and do some things to get it to fully recover. Anyway, making all sorts of measurements, we can get gains, which would be the measured peak energy out minus the chemical energy in, and we're treating this as adiabatic, so we just go to the peak of the curve to get these numbers. Then you get gains that are, in other words, this is attributed to this anomalous reaction. Call it anomalous. I agree if we ever started calling them anomalous because, as I say, until we measure reaction products from these, we aren't really convinced we know what the reaction is. And now this is a picture of some of the problems after we've run 40 hours. ICCF 18 posters I referenced, we have lots of pictures like this, and you can look at those if you're interested. So we're looking at things to increase the lifetime of the particles. We've studied increased oxide layer thicknesses, changes in composition, embedding particles. Again, the Greek particles are embedded in a foam, and that's a tempting thing to do, but you lose power density in the process. Another thing is control the reactor temperature. One of our problems is the temperature in the center line is much higher than the outside in those, even in that little vessel. And so that causes the center line ones to deteriorate more rapidly. And so anyway, all that is included in this future work, which we have a lot to do. And so that's all in progress. Now, so in summary, these pressurized nanoparticle power units are very encouraging, but there's a lot to do before we can achieve that vision I showed you at the very beginning and compete with the other green energy. Incidentally, I've given this talk at a green energy meeting, and the solar people and the wind people and so on don't like this at all. More information. I want to talk about fast ignition using this concept. Now, the main reason I'm doing this is to show off. No. The main reason I'm doing it is that to show that these clusters really exist and so on. And so we've used it here. It's sort of interesting, and we collaborate a lot with Kirk Philippoff at Los Alamos using a Trident laser. And this is a different team than the LENR team. And before we worry about the slides, let me explain. In laser fusion, what you do is you try to hit a target of deuterium, tritium, and ablate the outer surface so that it compresses in, heats itself, and then fuses, and it should produce enough alpha particles to self-heat itself and get a burn. And The problem with that is it's like our thin films, the gain's not too high. It's hard to get a gain over 10 doing that type of thing. And so it'd be very nice if you could magically not heat the whole particle, but just heat a small spot in the center, have that ignite, and then the alpha particle burn would cause it to burn out into the other part. And so people started studying how to do that with a laser. They compress this target, bring in a second laser, which produces hot electrons, relativistic electrons at this point would go in, presumably produce that hot spot. That was studied at Livermore, but the trouble is that the relativistic electron beam formed is unstable and it doesn't really condense into the center of that whole target. So then what people have done, and Los Alamos Smith, leader in this, is put a film here so that they hit this with a laser driving, they put plastic there driving protons in, which is good, but the proton beam is not that stiff, so it doesn't condense quite as well. And so what we've been supposed to do, and we got money from the DOE to study it, was use our thin film clusters to create deuteron beams. In other words, we have this foil right here is composed of the foils we make, and we would hit that with this laser. Now this laser, the petawatt laser, the main laser that compresses the beam is the big NIF laser, you know, it has 2 megajoules, and it hits it fairly slowly, whereas this petawatt laser comes in from the side and zaps it at a tremendous peak power, but not much energy. And I don't know, if you go to whole rooms, this is more complicated configuration there, and neglect that. So, as I said, people use particle beams for this, electrons, protons. Los Alamos was trying to get something heavier, they were using carbon. They couldn't get a good film to make deuterium, so that's where we sort of came in. And then the nice thing about deuterium is you're knocking that into a DT target, so the deuterium fuses in the target with the deuterium and tritium, and you get a bonus. Not only do you heat to the slowing down, but you get added fusion, and that's called the F factor, and we did a lot of calculations on that, and so that was attractive. So we used this Trident laser at Los Alamos, which is a petawatt laser, and a big advantage of this Trident laser is that it has a very high contrast ratio. That is, most of the lasers, in fact, have a precursor that hits the target first, producing a plasma surface, and then the main beam comes in. And you don't want that for this, because what you want is to hit it. And what it does is it drives the electron. The laser light couples to the electrons, drives that out. That sucks the deuterium out from the clusters or whatever you have. And that comes out at MeV energies. And so that's what we're looking at. And so this is the arrangement we had. And this target is hard to see because it's right there, and it's only yay big. It's less than a half a square centimeter. And so the laser beam comes in, bounces around, it's focused onto the target. And down here we have our diagnostics and analyzers and so on. And we got 4 shots on this thing. This is a usage facility, and that's all we could afford at that time. And we were using 20 watts per square centimeter in the surface. Forget about the rest of it. It's tremendous. And these are some results from film on the Thompson Parabola. And one of the problems is that the deuterium that we're looking for coming out is masked, because we can't tell the difference between it and the carbon 6 that might be coming out. And carbon is sort of, we've been talking about impurities and everything. You know, Peter's talking about mercury and others talking about other impurities, and carbon's pretty hard to get rid of in these experiments, so it's there whether you want it or not. And we also had protons, unfortunately. It's hard to get a clean surface. So what we did was we put a filter in, titanium filter, to filter out the carbon, and we see the deuterium here. We still have a lot of protons coming in. Protons we don't want. One reason is they suck up some of the energy you want going into the deuterium, but that's the way it is. So anyway, this was very encouraging, and we did get a deuterium. We got 6 MeV or so deuterium beads coming out of that thing from the cluster, and so this looked like a way to do this fast ignition, taking advantage of this bonus energy gain due to fusion as that slows down and so on. So if laser fusion works, this might have a role in that. And now, unfortunately, after we did this, we want to go back. We now have a plasma cleaning device to clean the surface in situ so it wouldn't have the protons and the carbon and so on. But the Trident was a user's facility when we were there a year and a half ago, and now it's no longer a user's facility, and we'd have to pay $75,000 for what I just showed you, which we don't have. So, whereas as a user facility, we could propose it and they would pay for it. I don't know where we're going in this experiment. We don't have enough money from DOE to afford to do the experiment that they want us to do.
What about Austin?
Yeah, Austin's good. In fact, the gal who won the LENR scholarship and worked for me, and it was at the meeting in Missouri, went to Austin. She has a postdoc, or not postdoc, I mean, she's doing her PhD with the Austin Petawatt Laser Group. Unfortunately, their contrast ratio is not as good as Trident, but I got my eye on that since I have a person down there I know. So, conclusion, this cluster-type materials may have a role in LENR and in deuterium fast beam. I didn't put on here, the thing I like about it is, you know, before when we were doing LENR, it was hard to know what we were trying to change. Here we know that we're trying to make these vacancies of a certain size, and we're trying to make a lot of them per cubic centimeter, and we're trying to get stuff to condense into them. And so I feel like we have a handle on what we're doing. Whether or not that's the right approach, I don't know, but that's what we're doing. Thank you.
George, I got a question.
Yeah.
When you deload, you see a massive rise of heat. How do you know you're not getting redistribution of the deuterons to your dislocation loops, and that there you're getting an increase as you deload the palladium or the nanomaterial?
Yeah. Well, we have no proof. We don't know.
But you have a means of measuring the density in the dislocation loops, don't you?
Well, the one thing we did back with thin film, you know, we did do some neutron scattering experiments at NIST. That was the only way we had it. And since we've started this nanoparticle stuff, we haven't had the money needed to do that. Now, Missouri, I think you guys are doing neutron scatter. I'll have to talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be very interesting.
George, I have a comment on your lifetime tests that you got to do to sell it to the government.
Yeah.
I was involved with a project to put heat engines on plutonium-238 heat sources to go for 6% efficient with the silicon-germanium couples, which are in our radioisotope thermoelectric generators.
which have been operating for more than 40 years now on the Voyager spacecraft. What I'm going to tell you is that the contract required a 5,000-hour lifetime test to be able to make that device saleable to the Air Force.
So what do you do?
They weren't able to do it. Piecemeal could barely get to 1,000 hours. I just want to give you a number that you got to be able to make. You got to be able to make a 5,000-hour life test, which is approximately 6 months, I think. Mitchell calculated that out. It's close to 6 months.
What I want to do is an accelerated test where, you know, if I identify what the deterioration cause is, then I can measure that continuously over time.
Well, this is exactly my point.
Try to convince somebody.
You got to have degradation under control for at least 6 months or you can't sell. So they canceled the program because they couldn't do it. Mm-hmm.
Your experiment is for some aspect similar that made by NASA people come in 1999 quite a performance due to nanomaterials, subject micrometry. I should work on some other big difference in respect to Kravik experiment.
Well, I'm not sure which NASA experiment. NASA, I know of, but what they did was they fused through a membrane, play a membrane, and measured the heat. But you know, there we're talking about gains and so on here of 10, 20, so on in short periods, and theirs was they were lucky to get 1.5.
Yeah.
So there's no comparison.
Yeah, sure, I agree. So it seems like very light increasing due to tumor micrometric material. Mm-hmm. Is it good, is the right understanding?
I guess.
The density of those clusters, is that comparable at all to what has recently been found, you know, super dense titanium? Have you heard about super dense titanium?
Super dense, well, you mean metallic material? Yeah. Yeah, well, this is close to metallic.
It has a huge specific mass.
So you know, people, I think here at Harvard, there's this big experiment using a high pressure anvil to create metallic hydrogen. And these clusters are wonderful. I mean, we're almost doing it
for free.
So I don't know, that itself should be a great, you know, step.
Well, it would be good to measure the density. That's why I say, for you to say how far you're off of the other guys.
Yeah, well, we'll have to write a paper. But we do have papers accepted, you know, on the superconducting characteristics of low temperature and stuff like that, which is comply with your talking. Yes.
Did you take the pressurizing, depressurizing power into account of the power gain?
Well, I didn't show any power gains for the complete cycle. So when we do all that, it cuts the power gain we had down by about 20%. But it's still very significant.
George, you may have said this, but can you start the reaction at will on and off? And how do you initiate it?
Well, the way it was initiated, I puzzled over in my sleep. no one else seems to do it this way. As I say, all we do is allow the absorption to heat it up to a temperature where it takes off. So the threshold temperature for LNR is start, which I think some other people also observe. So that's all we do.
Okay.
But to keep it going, we have to
keep this flow, and that's where we get into trouble. Then we have to do something else.
Right. Okay.
Would you consider preheating with a resistive element similar to what our Japanese friends are doing here?
That sounds good. We our original thinking was, well, this is free. It happens anyway, so we didn't try it. We should do it.
Yes. I had a question. You showed the thin film experiment, and you mentioned it was 12 micrometers thickness, yeah, for the palladium. What was the thickness on the palladium oxide? Do you know that, or is that important?
It's about 3 or so. It's somewhat imprecise.
Okay.
Why are you oxidizing zirconium?
The zirconium?
Yeah.
Well, going back to Arata and so on, this has been something that has enhanced these reactions, and it also seems to enhance the formation of the phosphate. But I need to do much more research on that. This is an excellent question.
When you talk to your friends in the hot fusion site,
it's going to take for DOE or the nuclear industry or whatever to recognize this. And my experience has been they don't want to talk to us because we have data that they can't explain. What's your experience?
Well, when I did these experiments in Los Alamos, I didn't tell them that we were Los Alamos.
Yeah, the price would have been $150,000. Just a couple of comments. One, I wasn't surprised to hear that even your small reactor vessel sees a high temperature gradient through the powder, and I would expect your larger vessel to see a prohibitively high temperature gradient.
Yeah, so actually, I didn't show the details, but we plan to have that section off.
Section off?
Yeah. In other words, you have layers around, so if you limit the heat temperatures.
Or you could put fins on the inside. Yeah. The other thing was your thermoelectric generators were all in line, and you're going to decrease your delta T at the back end of those. But if you put manifolds all around them and have a fresh water stream hitting each one of them and then exiting, they all get the maximum delta T.
We've talked about that. Now, we needed to. We're planning to do one of those that's electrically heated to get a first technology issue. So,
we need better than all that.
Thank you. Oh, I'm sorry.